Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org. Support for WPR comes from Wills on behalf of Wisconsin Public Libraries, offering access to ebooks, audiobooks, digital magazines, and more. Available with a Wisconsin Library card at wisconsinsdigitallibrary.org.
Speaking with Stanislav Grof, author of a number of books, including When the Impossible Happens and The Ultimate Journey. You've said that your life changed dramatically one day in 1956, the first time you took LSD. What happened then?
Well, I initially wanted to work in animated movies, and then reading Freud changed my decision. I enrolled at a medical school, became a psychiatrist, and then as I was getting sort of deeper into psychoanalysis, I was more and more disappointed. Initially, not actually with the theory, but with the practice, how long it takes, how much money, and so on. So I kind of started regretting having chosen this discipline, and I should have sort of really gone into animated movies. That would have been a better career. And then something happened that really changed, in one day, changed my life personally, professionally. I was working at the psychiatric department of the School of Medicine in Prague. And we just finished a large study of a substance called Meleril, which came from Switzerland, from Sandoz Pharmaceutical Company. So we had a very good working relationship with them. And one day we got a box of ampules. We opened it and it said LSD-25. It came with a letter from Sandoz. It said this was a very interesting sort of investigative new substance that was discovered basically by accident by Dr. Hoffman, who intoxicated himself accidentally when he worked with the substance.
Albert Hoffman,
yeah. And there was a Swiss psychiatrist, Dr. Stoll, who did a pilot study with a group of quote-unquote normal people and a group of psychiatric patients and published this paper on LSD that overnight became a sensation. And the sensation was not that much the psychedelic effect, because mescaline was already known and in a pure form, but it was the incredible power. You know, millions of a gram changed mental functioning for hours. So this supply came from Sandoz, and they say, would you work with the substance? We feel that maybe there is some use for it in psychiatry and psychology.
So the idea then was the use would be for therapeutic purposes.
Well, it was, he actually mentioned possibility of psychotherapy, but the main focus was experimental psychosis, that when he gave it to these people, it seemed that the experiences that they were having were very similar to what you see in naturally occurring psychosis. And so this would be like a model that we could work with. When you take a group of quote-unquote normal people, do all kinds of tests, psychological, electrophysiological, biochemical, give them the substance, repeat them, and then again afterwards, and you would get an insight as to what's happening biologically when you know, the mental functioning is so profoundly influenced. And if this is the case, then what we call mental diseases might not be mental diseases at all. They would be kind of aberrations of body chemistry. It was conceivable that the human body could produce under certain circumstances these minuscule dosages of this similar substance, if not LSD per se. And if that's the case, then we would develop some kind of antidote. And you would have something that would be a holy grail in psychiatry, which means a test tube solution for schizophrenia and other psychosis.
So here you were, a young psychiatrist. This shipment of LSD just arrived at your lab in Prague. You decided to take some?
Well, there was a suggestion in the letter, maybe this could be used as a model psychosis, experimental psychosis. But there was a little other tip, which kind of became my destiny or karma, if you want. It said, there's a possibility that this substance could be used as a kind of unconventional educational tool that psychologists, psychiatrists, nurses, students would have the chance to spend a few hours in the world that was very much like the world of their patients, and as a result of it, be able to understand them better, to communicate with them more effectively, and hopefully be more successful in treating them as a result of it, which was certainly sorely needed in psychiatry. And so I was in this situation when I was really regretting having chosen psychoanalysis, and this seemed like a whole new possibility. So I became, you know, one of the early volunteers, and that's where I had an experience that was in, you know, a few hours really changed me personally and sent me professionally in a completely new direction.
What happened during that first experience?
Well, my preceptor was very interested in electroencephalography, and at the time when he got this sample from Sandoz, he was particularly interested in what's called brain driving the brain waves, or entraining the brain waves, which means exposing people to a stroboscopic light and then finding a in the suboccipital area, in the EEG, electroencephalography, if the brainwaves pick up the frequency that you are feeding in. So those of us who wanted the session also had to agree to have the our brainwaves driven in the middle of this experiment. So between the third and fourth hour, when my experience with LSD was culminating, which was powerful enough, this research assistant came and said this was time for the experiment. So she took me into a small room. I lay down. She put the electrodes on my head and then asked me to close my eyes and then put this gigantic strobe, you know, put it above my head and turn this thing on.
So you had a strobe light.
Strobe light on top of the
effect. On top of the LSD.
And suddenly there was light like I had never seen in my life. I couldn't even imagine existed. Like when you read about the mystical experiences, like millions of suns. At the time, I thought this is what must have been like in Hiroshima when the bomb went off. Today, I think it was more like what's called Dharmakaya in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the primary clear light that you see at the moment of your death. But what happened, my consciousness was catapulted out of my body. I lost the research assistant, the clinic, Prague, the planet. And suddenly I had the feeling I became nothing. My old self was extinguished, but I had the feeling I became all of existence. As I was sort of coming down a little later, I had the feeling of being in the physical universe or even being the universe. And there were things happening for which at the time I didn't have names. But later I read about the Big Bang and the black holes and white holes. And
you're saying you had visions of this, sort of like the Big Bang and black holes?
Yeah, but I was it at the same time. It's very difficult to describe. Usually the mystic says things are ineffable that happened. And as I was sort of going through this, she was being very scientific. She took the strobe, like, from 2 hertz to frequencies per second up to 60 and back, and kept it for a while in the alpha band and then the theta band and the delta band, following the protocol, and then turn it off. And then, my consciousness started shrinking again. I found the planet. I found Prague. I found my body. And then for quite a while, I had great difficulties connecting my body, aligning my body somehow with my consciousness, or consciousness with my body. And I understood that what they taught me in the medical school about consciousness is somehow coming out of the complexity of the neurophysiological processes in the brain simply was not true, that consciousness was something much, much larger. It was a kind of a cosmic phenomenon, and that somehow our individual psyche partakes, in this larger cosmic matrix, or is kind of teased out of it and gets connected somehow to this experience of body, but those are two different things.
You're saying you came to that conclusion right away, just from this very first experience? Or is it something that you had to reflect on and to work out in your mind?
Well, I mean, the basic idea was there. And of course, then years, you know, it is like over 50 years now. This was 1956. So then it got kind of fleshed out and, you know, crystallized when my additional sessions and all the observations with other people.
Now, what had been your orientation, your scientific orientation before that experience? Did you have a sort of a more conventional, materialistic understanding of science?
Well, I grew up in a family that had no religious affiliation. It kind of went back to a drama in our family when my mother and my father met in a small Czech town. My mother was from a strictly Catholic family. My father was from a family that had no church affiliation, and the local church refused to marry them. And it seemed like it wouldn't happen at all until my grandparents made a major financial donation to the church. And my parents got so upset by this. They didn't want to commit me or my brother to any religion. So we had classes in religion, actually, but for me this was a leisure. You know, this was a free hour, so I had no exposure. From this kind of background, I went to medical school at a time when we were controlled by the Soviet Union. So we got the purest materialistic doctrine that you can have.
So you were you were an atheist at that time.
I was an atheist, convinced, you know, I thought I had a scientific worldview. The history of the universe is the history of matter, and somehow life, consciousness, intelligence is something that happened after billions of years of this development of matter, which was reactive, which was dead, and it happened as a kind of fluke in an insignificant part of the universe that has, you know, billions of galaxies.
So then you had this quite literally, this mind-blowing experience, which you say changed your life. I mean, changed.
So I'm a somewhat unusual case of somebody who was brought to mysticism, not to religion, but to mysticism, to spirituality, by scientific research, laboratory and clinical research. Usually it's the other way around. People get, very intense religious indoctrination. And when they discover materialistic science, they tend to say the whole thing is nonsense, unscientific, you know, primitive, magical thinking. I am a scientist. I am a rational person. And they tend to reject anything related not just to religion but to spirituality. And they usually don't distinguish between some kind of primitive folk superstition and systems like Tibetan Buddhism or Sufism, you know, based on centuries of intense personal self-exploration.
So what happened then in your career after that? It sounds like you entirely switched tracks.
Well, I joined a group of scientists who were both sort of psychologists, psychiatrists, and biochemists working in a group of research institute in Prague who had access to psychedelics. And for the first 2 years, we pursued the experimental psychosis idea, which means we had a group of about 40 people, including ourselves, who came to the research institute and then get one of psychedelics that we had, LSD, then we had psilocybin. We had already the tryptamine derivatives, which were developed in Budapest by Dr. Zara. We had mescaline from from Germany.
Was all this legal to do at the time?
It was legal, yeah. And so we came for a day and we got one of the psychedelic substances. And then we came for a day where we got a placebo. And both during the placebo days and the psychedelic days, we were going through a series of investigations. We were drawing blood, you know, every hour on the hour. We were collecting samples of urine. We were doing electrophysiological experimentation, you know, very, very scientific. And during this time, something started dawning on me. You see, we were doing these giving these substances in the same dosages and the same circumstances, and each of the experimental persons had a very different kind of experience, unbelievable range of experiences. So I realized this was not an ordinary pharmacon. You wouldn't have pharmacology if you wouldn't know exactly what the effects would be. If you give it to them and you don't know what's going to come up. And then also, if we had the same substance repeatedly, each session was different. And then at a certain point, I realized we are actually working with a catalyst. We are not having LSD experiences or psilocybin experiences. We are having experiences of ourselves.
It would seem that the psychedelic, whether LSD or psilocybin, was triggering something inside your head.
Yeah, well, but it was clear that this was bringing something from the depths of the unconscious, which was there anyway. So I started seeing something like LSD, like a microscope or a telescope, like a tool that makes it possible for you to study phenomena which were real but were not available without using that. You know, the telescope supposedly doesn't create new galaxies. We believe they are there, and we wouldn't see them if we didn't have that. The same with the microscope. So the LSD became for me like a tool to explore the psyche, and I moved out of this group. And I started, I went back to psychoanalysis, but now sort of LSD-assisted or psychedelic-assisted psychoanalysis. And that was the beginning of a whole other era, discovering somehow the dimensions of the psyche.
So then you continued your scientific research, and you would bring people into...
Yeah, but this time it was clinical.
Right.
It was clinical research, patients who couldn't be helped by any of the other existing therapeutic methods, and giving them, you know, mostly LSD, psilocybin to some of them, and spending them with them, you know, 5-6 hours, keeping records what was happening, giving them the best possible support I could, and then asking them afterwards to write an account.
How many sessions do you figure you sat in on?
Personally, in probably over 4,000 psychedelic sessions over the years.
Over 4,000?
Yeah.
Has anyone else witnessed so many psychedelic sessions?
Not in the academic circle, but I know there are people who are doing it in outside of the official.
Yeah. And to put this into perspective, I mean, this was all before Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert did their infamous studies at Harvard.
You know, Tim Leary had his first session in 65, whereas the session I described was like 56, almost 10 years before. So by that time, LSD was very respectable. And Czechoslovakia, I was born in Prague, Czechoslovakia was one of the two countries officially producing pharmaceutically pure LSD, Switzerland and then Czechoslovakia. So we had not only the official permission to do it, but we were one of the two countries where pure pharmaceutical LSD was available. LSD was at that time printed in the official Czech pharmacopoeia together with insulin, you know, tetracycline, antibiotics, caffeine.
Times have changed, haven't they?
Side effects, you know.
Times have changed.
Yeah. And we had a system that people had to go through in order to get the permission. You had to have 5 personal experiences and then 30 sessions with clients which were supervised by somebody who already had the experience, and then you could get your own. And you had to have a PhD or an MD. It was strictly professional.
Now, so you said that you were using this in a clinical setting. I mean,
yes.
you were treating patients. What kind of results came out of people using a substance like LSD?
Well, we saw, you know, positive changes in patients who couldn't be changed by anything else. And the effects were just far beyond anything that you can achieve by talking.
What kinds of effects? What actually happened to these people?
what happened is that they would regress to childhood. It would take them to memories which had a strong emotional charge, and these memories would emerge into consciousness. They would be able to express the emotions, and if there are certain physical energies held back, they would sort of be expressed in tremors and movements and so on. So it was like an experience of purging. I mean, the substance itself would find the areas that needed to be worked on, which was already tremendous, because you know, we have in psychotherapy number of schools, and each school tells you something different about how the psyche functions, why the symptoms are there, what they mean, and particularly how you work with them, you know. Whereas here, it's the inner healing intelligence that starts operating, and you have to basically become a co-adventurer. You just support what is happening. You are not in charge. You are not telling people where to go or what it's about. They tell you where they have been.
Now, the way you're describing this, it sounds like a very positive experience. I mean, you've used words like healing and unlocking things that were buried. Was it always positive?
Psychedelics are catalysts. You see, that sort of changed the relationship between the unconscious and consciousness in favor of unconscious. The unconscious becomes available. Now, whether this would be healing, transformative, or if it's going to be destructive, does not depend on the drug itself. We talk a lot about set and setting, you know, who does it, for what purposes, what is the context, what is the support that you're giving to the person. So it's very different, you know, if you prepare the patient for 10 hours and then you have one or ideally two, we were using male-female also dyad, and these people would stay with the person for several hours, and then you keep the person safe overnight, and then you talk with them in the next morning. That's a somewhat different setting than what was happening in Woodstock, where they were sort of, you know, handing out all kinds of stuff, full hands, nobody knew what they were getting, you know, there was nobody holding the kite string, as we talk, nobody.
This can be very destructive. If it's used the
wrong
way.
It was also considered as chemical warfare. You know, there are all kinds of experiments that were done by the military and by secret service. You could compromise diplomats when you put it in their, you know, in their drink. There were fantasies about putting it in water supply and, you know, disorganize life in the cities and then take over, use it in aerosols. We had this very interesting experience. We got a supply of a substance called niamide, which was a tricyclic antidepressant. And we were doing, work with depressed patients. And then the dose of them who were not helped with this were then put into this LSD program. And we found out that after they had the pre-medication was niamide, we couldn't get LSD reaction for 3 weeks from them. And we published a little, paper we thought was an interesting observation in a very obscure Czech journal. And within a very short time, we got over 100 requests from mostly from military, you know, VA hospitals and so on. And we realized that they had a fantasy of pre-medicating their soldiers with niamide and then, you know, getting somehow LSD into the city or into the unit of the enemy and then simply bring their own, resistant people and take over.
You're talking about very powerful substances.
Yeah, it's not, you know, there were also these instances. There was a situation in Pentagon when they wanted to test what it would look like and gave it to somebody, and the person thought he was going crazy and jumped out of the window. And bad things can happen with alcohol, which is nowhere as powerful as LSD. So there is a tremendous potential. There's also a big danger. You know, if you use something that doesn't have big risks, and it also does not have, you know, great potential. But the more powerful the tool, the greater risks you are taking.
So what you've described so far is your the early part of your career, starting out as a psychiatrist, using the techniques of psychoanalysis, working in clinical settings, trying to help people sort out some of their personal issues. At some point, you maybe from the very beginning, I don't know, you became very interested in what's been called non-ordinary states of consciousness. Obviously, we're talking about some of these now.
Well, that was actually my first session. This was a non-ordinary state. And,
right.
And then right there, I felt I'm stuck with psychiatry. And if you're a psychiatrist, this is by far the most interesting thing you can study. So I will study these non-ordinary states.
So where did you go with that, though? Because it seems like you took this interest in non-ordinary states of consciousness in various different directions.
So there were the first 2 years, which was this sort of experimental work, experimental psychosis. And then in that process, discovering that we are dealing really with a catalyst and a tremendous tool to explore the psyche, something that can get you into the unconscious much faster and much deeper than talking. And if there is anything to psychoanalysis, this could actually deepen and accelerate the therapeutic process. So I became interested in these two different aspects of psychedelics. One we can call heuristic, H-E-U-R, something that can really help you to help you learn something about the psyche, you know, on levels that are not normally available. And then the second one was the therapeutic, something that could really accelerate the therapy in the patients who are somehow available for therapy, but also extend it to categories that that we cannot influence in any other way. So I think the most important part of my work then became mapping the psyche. So I came with this very narrow model of psychoanalysis, which is basically limited to postnatal biography and the Freudian individual unconscious.
You know, postnatal, you mean after we're born?
Yeah, Freud. Yeah. Freud said the newborn is a tabula rasa, is a clean slate. There's nothing there of interest for a psychologist. So who you become depends on what happens to you after birth, what kind of mother you have, what kind of nursing, or toilet training, psychosexual traumas, and so on. And suddenly, when we were working with psychedelics, this just proved to be painfully narrow, painfully superficial.
Why?
And when people took LSD, it took them first to birth. Suddenly, they started talking about, you know, being trapped in the system that was killing them, that they couldn't sort of get out of, and they had the feeling they're going crazy, they're going to die, they will never come back. And birth was not part of my conceptual framework. You see, this is not something that I was taught in psychiatry during medical studies or in my psychoanalytic training.
Well, supposedly we can't really remember back to our birth. I mean, our brain hasn't been developed.
Yeah, the idea, you know, in the medical studies was that the cortex of the newborn is not mature enough. The technical term is not myelinized. The neurons don't have the fatty sheets sort of protecting them. And this is given as a kind of very authoritative reason. You know, how could you remember birth? Your brain is not myelinized. Now, when I saw these experiences and then I experienced it myself, I realized the experiences are there. It's up to the neurophysiologist to show where it is recorded and how it is recorded.
You're saying that there were times when you took LSD or another psychedelic, you went back to the moment of birth yourself?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. I had several sessions, very, very high dose sessions that took me through birth with all the stages, you know, with details.
What makes you think that you really did that, as opposed to it was some sort of a reconstructed imaginary trip that as if you were going back to the moment of birth.
But it's extremely authentic. You know, when I was in the womb, for example, I tasted the amniotic fluid, which I never tasted, you know, in my postnatal life, and I couldn't sort of conjure up. Many people with whom I worked gave details about what happened during their birth without having intellectual knowledge of their birth, and we had the chance to go into birth records or talk to the mother or some other people and verify that. I have actually a couple of stories in the book when the impossible happens, when people remembered things at the time when they were in the womb, or they remembered what happened after they were born.
Can you tell me about one of these stories that you heard?
One of the stories was actually from holotropic breathwork. That is a non-drug method that my wife Christina and I mm-hmm. developed, where you just use accelerated breathing, music, and certain kind of body work. And there was a psychologist who was quite conservative, just barely opening up to come to something like holotropic breathwork. And he got in a state where he felt caught, trapped, and was fighting. There were several of us that had to sort of hold him down and encourage him to go through. And then he had, tremendous kind of a release, got into a very relaxed and peaceful place. And then during the sharing, said, when he was describing, he said, the most unusual thing was when he got born, there was this very intense smell of fresh leather. And he asked me, how could that be part of birth? And I said, I don't know. This would have to be part of the ambience, or it certainly doesn't belong to birth itself. And then he checked with his mother, and it turned out he was Austrian, he grew up in the Tyrol, and his mother was involved in making what's called Lederhosen, the leather, typical mm-hmm. leather pants. And so she was inexperienced. This was her first pregnancy. She was in a shop. She was sewing these pants, and then the labor pain came. She thought she was just getting sick. But then actually it turned out to be birth, unsupported, when she was alone. And so he was born into this environment, when they were sort of fresh, cut leather all over the place. So, so we had some histories of this kind. Now I realize also that there's unbelievable logical problem with how mainstream psychiatrists think about birth, because there is a general agreement that the situation immediately following birth is extremely psychologically important. Even child psychiatrists and pediatricians believe in the importance of bonding, just the exchange of the looks between the newborn and the mother. And then, of course, nursing is generally considered to be important. Mm-hmm. We have now a lot of research, and prenatal research, showing the sensitivity of the fetus already in the womb. So you have a sensitive creature in the womb, sensitive right after the birth, but that creature didn't notice what could have been hours of a life-threatening situation, and it's not recorded anywhere.
But you're saying those few hours at the moment of birth could affect someone 50 years later?
All through the life, yes. Well, if you imagine that the ordinary traumas that we deal with in psychoanalysis have some kind of lifetime impact, this is a situation that could be 30, 40, 50 hours. That fetus could have died in the birth canal and had to be resuscitated. I mean, it's a trauma on a completely different level. Now, in terms of the myelinization, we know that you don't need not only a myelinized brain, you don't need a brain at all to have memories, because in biology they will tell you that memory is really a property of living matter.
What do you mean? Memory is a matter of living.
Protoplasmatic, yeah. Eric Kandel, for example, got a Nobel Prize, I think 15 years ago or so, for his study of memory mechanism in a sea slug, aplysia. So sea slugs have memories, but the newborn cannot have memory of birth because the cortex was not myelinated. You don't need a brain to have memory. I mean, it's something that belongs to biology. So there is this unbelievable logical inconsistency, you see, in the thinking. The only way I can understand it now is that the memory is so scary that we just don't want to go there. We don't want to deal with it. And we actually can use our intellect in science by explaining it away. This couldn't have been important. My cortex was not myelinized, you see.
But there still is a standard view. I mean, you talk to neuroscientists and 98% of them, 90 more than that, I would guess, would say that everything that happens in our minds is based on brain function. The physical nature of the brain is what generates consciousness.
Well, I think that's related to another problem because, I mean, there is a very highly developed material organ, the brain of the newborn child. The problems start when you go further back, when, let's say, you start having experiences of early embryonal stage. Or I have a number of instances where people experience something from the life of their ancestors or experience something, identify with their father at a time 15 years before their conception.
You're saying somehow that they can perceive this, something that happened to their own parents?
Yes. And then you have this whole area of the Jungian collective unconscious where you can have experiences from human history, from different periods of human history. Jung also talked about the archetypal collective unconscious where we can experience mythology of other cultures that we have never studied in this lifetime. So that's there we really get to the problem of, where is that? Where does that come from?
And when you start talking about Carl Jung and his notion of the collective unconscious, I mean, which has been a tremendously powerful idea for the last century, I think a lot of people would say, fascinating, but you've left science by this point. Are you still in the scientific realm here when you talk about this kind of thing?
Well, I believe you are in a scientific realm, but science isn't there yet. I mean, the materialistic science is not there. We are talking about what John Magg, who was a Harvard psychoanalyst, talked about as anomalous experiences. There are certain experiences that the current conceptual framework cannot explain, but that doesn't mean that those experiences don't exist, you see. Thomas Kuhn wrote this book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, where he showed how many times this happened in scientific history, that the whole generation, the academy, was thinking about the universe in a certain way, and then observations came that were challenging it, and then there was a chaos and struggle, and then some whole new understanding emerges and history is rewritten until something else comes. So there was a time of the geocentric astronomy. It took, after Copernicus, it took 100 years before the heliocentric system was accepted. There was a time when in chemistry, there was the idea there is this royal substance, phlogiston, and all the other substances are compounds involving phlogiston. And when people like Lavoisier and Dalton came with the atomic theory, they think this was crazy. And people were fired because they didn't believe in phlogiston.
What you're saying is that our standard theory of consciousness, I mean, what most scientists today, what most philosophers of mind would say, the mind is a product of brain function. You're saying that really just doesn't hold up based on your own experiences on your research. True?
Yes. First of all, very few people realize, including people in the scientific circles, that we have absolutely no proof that consciousness is coming from the brain. we have proof that there are systematic correlations between states of consciousness and the anatomy, physiology of the brain.
Right. If certain parts of the brain are damaged, for instance, it can dramatically change mental function.
You have a temporal tumor, you have certain changes of consciousness which are different from the changes that you would have with a frontal tumor and so on. You cut off the oxygen supply and you lose consciousness. So there are these systematic correlations. But then there is a big logical jump, which is made, which is called technically non sequitur. It doesn't really follow. None of it shows that consciousness actually is generated in the brain.
But isn't that the obvious explanation?
No. I usually give the example of television, you see. There is a systematic correlation between what's happening with the components in the television set and the kind of program you get, the picture, the sound. Now, all that it says that there is a systematic correlation. It's not a proof that the program is generated in the box. And then if you study the box down to the molecular level of all the wires there, that one day you will understand why, Sullivan showed up at 7 o'clock with the Beatles, or why you get a Mickey Mouse cartoon. It still leaves open the possibility that the set mediates the program, but the program is coming from somewhere else.
So okay, well, let's play on this idea then. If consciousness is not generated by the brain, where is it? Where does it come from? What is it?
Okay, I have had quite a few psychedelic experiences myself and others that were non-drug, like with the breath work and so on. And I have sit with, over 4,000 people. We have done the holotropic breath work with probably over 35,000 people, including large groups. So today, if I would answer the question, I would be somewhere where the great Eastern spiritual philosophies are, that consciousness is a primary attribute of existence. It's a cosmic phenomenon. It cannot be reduced to anything else. And I think I would end up in a situation where it would be easier for me to imagine what's described in the great Asian scriptures, that the material reality is a virtual reality created by cosmic consciousness. This would be easier for me to imagine than the fact that matter, which is dead, inert, reactive, can generate something like consciousness. I mean, the gap is so phenomenal there. And this is the point, you see. We have shown these correlations, but nobody has ever tried to show how matter could possibly generate consciousness. We have, studied the brain to a great, great depth and so on, but nobody has ever published, to my knowledge, any theory how it could possibly happen, that matter would generate consciousness. A number of years ago, I went to a bookstore and I see a book by Francis Crick, who is the co-adventurer of the helical structure of DNA. And it was called
The Astonishing
Hypothesis, with a note that was on the book, Nobel Prize-winning scientist explains consciousness. So I said, wow, I have to read this, you see. So I started reading it, and I see the astonishing hypothesis is your hopes and sorrows and joys and worries is nothing but the activity of your neurons. Okay, so I open it, and he says, well, let's simplify it a little. Let's look at what's happening when you look at something. Let's say, I'm looking at you, so according to materialistic science, this is a material object. Light is reflected, it comes to my retina, creates electric changes, chemical changes, that creates a chemical impulse, a neural impulse going through the optical tract, ends up in the suboccipital cortex, more electricity, more chemical changes. And then he gives pages and pages of experiments proving this, that all this is happening when I'm watching something. And then he leaves it there, where actually that's where the problem begins. What is it that can create from electric and chemical changes a reasonable facsimile of what is there, gives it to me as a conscious experience in living colors, okay? It sort of reminds me of the Sufi story, you know, where you have a guy under a lantern sort of crawling on his knees and looking for something. Another guy comes and says, what are you doing? He says, well, I lost my keys here, so I'm looking for them. The guy says, can I help you? And the two of them are crawling. And then the newcomer says, I can't find anything. Are you sure you lost it here? He says, oh, not here, over there. He says, well, why are you looking here? He says, because it's dark there. We wouldn't have a chance, you see. So we have a good chance of finding things, what's happening in the retina, what's happening in the neuronal tract, the optical tract, what's happening in the cortex. But then the fundamental question, how does consciousness come out of that process? Nobody has tackled it.
And you're saying that really the conceptual apparatus of modern science, of brain science, has no means of tackling that question.
It has no relevance to the nature and origin of consciousness, in my understanding. Even if you go as far as Stuart Hameroff, or you take it to the tubules, you see, which are
these
in the mitochondria.
Right. Mm-hmm.
When you see the whole thing functions like a computer and so on. And that maybe that's the interface where consciousness somehow is generated. You still are stuck with the question, how does that happen? How is it possible that matter can generate consciousness?
So is this a question that's just beyond science? Something that science will never be able to explain?
I think science is much better in answering questions related to how things happen rather than why things happen. We can, you know, we can do incredible things with electricity without really understanding what electricity is. It's a kind of a similar kind of situation. We have a false belief that we understand what electricity is, or electromagnetism, because we learn how to use it, you know, in our life. But that's not really an answer to the question, why, you know.
Well, earlier you said that one of the results of your early work with LSD is that it totally transformed your own conceptual understanding of the world. I mean, you had been an atheist, and then you said you moved to a more mystical understanding of the way things work. Taking off your scientific hat now and getting into the mindset of that more mystical understanding of the cosmos, do you come to any clearer understanding of some of these things we've been talking about?
I wrote that book called The Cosmic Game. It's called The Explorations of the Farther Reaches of Consciousness, or something like that, when I specifically focus on those parts of the sessions where people were dealing with ontological, cosmological questions, you know. What is the nature of the universe? Is it really just a material system that created itself, or does it have a master blueprint? Is there a kind of creative intelligence? If there is a creative principle, how am I related to the creative principle? Have I lived only once? Who are we? Where are we going? You know, why is evil in the world, and so on? And what I found out is that you get from people, you get bits and pieces of a worldview that is radically different from the materialistic worldview, but has a cohesion of its own. And it's really the way of looking at the universe that you find in systems that Aldous Huxley called perennial philosophy. There was a certain way of understanding the universe that emerged throughout centuries in different countries.
There was a commonality among various wisdom traditions, spiritual traditions.
And people who systematically experiment responsibly with these non-ordinary states, they come up with that kind of a worldview. This is you know, spirituality is a significant aspect of the human psyche. It is a critical aspect of the universal scheme of things. We are not material beings. We are not human beings having spiritual experiences. We are spiritual beings having human experience. Teilhard de Chardin, you know, the possibility that we might have had previous existences and so on. So that is a very, very coherent, you know, alternative view of looking at the world that happens to people who have the access to what I call holotropic states, which is a certain subgroup of these non-ordinary states of consciousness, the things that happen to shamans during initiatory crisis or the states they use when they're treating their clients, or what happened in rites of passage, what happened in the ancient mysteries, what happens to you in different forms of meditation and so on.
What are those kinds of experiences you're talking about then? You're talking about profound mystical experiences that have this sense of unity?
Well, that's part of it. But what I was talking about, that I found in the experiences of different people, bits and pieces of it that were basically feeding into this overarching alternative worldview. Like some of the people had past life experiences, which is a whole interesting category in its own right. Other people would have the experience of seeing the divine light, what they considered to be the creative principle. Others actually lost themselves in it, and they became it. Like in the Upanishads, the question, who am I, is tattvam asi, thou art that. You are Godhead. You are not an ordinary, you know, you're not an ordinary human being. Then other people would experience experiential identification with other species, both animal and botanical. You know, I had an experience of becoming a sequoia tree when my whole body image was a sequoia tree, and I was experiencing photosynthesis. I was experiencing exchange of minerals and water in the root system and so on.
Was this after you had taken LSD?
Yeah, in a psychedelic session, yes. Huh. So you see, not everybody has experienced this worldview in its totality. But if you sort of look at sessions where people ask these different questions, they are parts of this worldview, which is radically different. And it's not only similar to what Aldous Huxley talk about as perennial philosophy, but you find now also powerful connections to some scientific breakthroughs like quantum relativistic physics and new biology, you know, Sheldrake's morphogenetic fields and, you know, theory of chaos, the holographic paradigm, David Bohm and Carl Pribram's model, holographic model of the brain. My new hero is now Erwin Laszlo, who has this concept which he calls the connectivity hypothesis that answers many of the paradoxes and puzzles, you know, from modern physics, biology, psychology, and so on. And he talks about the so-called psi field, PSI, or Akashic field, which is like a subquantum field where everything that has ever happened remains recorded holographically, and is still available in these non-ordinary states.
Mm. And you're saying something that's not, doesn't have any material basis to it. There's no physical basis to it.
Fields, energy fields, something like that. Yeah. Or possibly the field of consciousness itself has a memory, you know. Now, this is very different from how we think. I mean, fields are acceptable in physics. Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this is also highly speculative. I mean, this is a theory that might support some of the kinds of experiences that you're talking about, but it would seem like it will always be just a theory because, I mean, there's no way that you could ever confirm that, could you?
You know, Erwin Laszlo wrote a lot of books, and many of them are popular books where he just gives people the essence of this. But he has, for example, the book, The Interconnected Universe, where he goes into the mathematics and the physics. It's not just something that he, you know, came up as a speculation. I mean, you really need to have some knowledge of mathematics and physics to follow that. He is a real scientist. He's a kind of polyhist or... So it's a, you know, it's a very serious hypothesis, and it's the only one I know, only scientific system that I know that gives me any kind of explanation how it is possible that I, for example, took LSD and suddenly was in ancient Egypt, or I was suddenly back in the French Revolution.
You're saying there's no way that that could just be a sort of a flight of fancy, a flight of the imagination.
The, you know, this is for a long time that I was trying to see it that way. But there's no doubt in my mind now that you can have experiences where the information which is coming is way beyond anything that you learned in this lifetime. You know, I've seen and had experiences of identification with animal species where you literally become those animals. You become an eagle and you have a body image of the eagle and you suddenly understand how you fly, how you work the air currents, you know. You see the world the way you would see through the optical system of an eagle, not through the optical system of a man. So there are not many people who think about the mechanics of the flight unless you are Leonardo da Vinci or something.
And so what you're saying then is where would those images come from if not this tapping into this kind of, I don't know, information field, energy field? You're saying it doesn't exist anywhere in your own head to begin with, so it has to come from somewhere else.
No, you know, even I had a long discussion with Carl Sagan, which is, you know, was a great astronomer, but for some reason he took on all these things that in his mind were unscientific.
He was a skeptic.
Yeah, he was a skeptic, you know. He wrote the book, The Demon-Haunted World, and so on. And I was one of the surviving people who had something to do with the beginnings of transpersonal psychology, and he asked for confrontation. And so Christina and myself and he and Anne, his wife, we met in a Boston hotel. So John Mack was there, whom I mentioned already. And he said, well, Stan, you're an educated person. You studied medicine and psychology, and people believe what you say. You cannot spread these delusions. And he says, you know, there's a lot of this hoax and scam in the world. We have to be scientific. He said there was a horse in Germany whom they called their Kluge Hans, the smart Hans, and claimed he could do mathematics. And they dug out a figure in Italy, which they claimed was a petrified giant. And I said, Carl, this is not what we are talking about. He says, well, what are we talking about? I say, well, about the ontological nature of transpersonal experiences. Can they be explained as fantasies, hallucinations, as something that you concocted out of you know, your everyday experience? He says, give me examples. So I mentioned these things like the eagle and so on. And he says, oh, American children watch television, you know, 6 hours a day, and you get a lot of information and the brain records it all. And if something comes out of there, it had to come through the senses, the old empiricist dictum. And then in my desperation, I brought the near-death experiences and gave him example from Carl Sabum's book, where a patient, you know, in a cardiac arrest was sort of watching this situation from the ceiling. And then
an out-of-body experience.
Yeah, out-of-body, and it came down and was watching the gauges and so on, and afterwards gave an explanation. And so I said, what do you think about things like this? And he said, this, of course, didn't happen. I said, didn't happen? You know, Carl Sabum is a cardiosurgeon. He studied his patients and he wrote a book about it. So what do you mean didn't happen? And says, I'll tell you, there are many cardiosurgeons in the world. Nobody would have known the guy, so he makes up the story. It's a PR trick. And I knew this was the end of the discussion. Once you start questioning the integrity, the sanity of the people who bring challenging experiences, it's a realm of fundamentalism. It's not science anymore. I mean, if he were a scientist, he would say, wow, is that true? I mean, let me look into it. Maybe let me do my own research if it's so critical, you know. But he already knew what the world is like, how it works, what is possible, what isn't possible, and nothing would convince him.
So if we return to what you were talking about earlier, the states of consciousness that go very deep, the kind of things that the shamans might be involved in, or as you mentioned, through certain rites of passage, those deepest states of consciousness, is that the experience of God? We've barely mentioned that word. Does that word have meaning to you?
That's what you feel when you experience it, yeah. We did breathwork with a group of Soviet scientists who came to Esalen, and one of them, and we were doing the sharing afterwards, and one of them had the experience of God, and there were some of his colleagues, and they obviously didn't quite trust each other, and he says, well, of course, I remain a communist, but I have to say, after 2 days' experience, I know what people mean when they say God.
Because it seems that a lot of what you've said so far would cut against the grain of the Western understanding of God, maybe through the monotheistic traditions. What you're talking about is something different, maybe more compatible with certain Eastern understandings.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mentioned that I had the privilege of being at the cradle of transpersonal psychology in that small group with Abraham Maslow and, Tony Sutich. One of the major problems when we had the idea what this new psychology would look like was how do we reconcile it with what we know as science. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, all these new discoveries were coming, quantum relativistic physics, Sheldrake, and all the things that I already mentioned. But then we also realized that what we are trying to do in transpersonal psychology is to show that science is not incompatible with spirituality. That doesn't mean that it is compatible with religion, with the dogma, you see. So the experiences that you have in these non-ordinary states are like the experiences of the mystics of the different religions. So if you have a Christian experience, it would be like Meister Eckhart or Hildegard von Bingen. Or if you have the kind of Islamic experience, it would be like what the Sufis experience. Or in the Judaic tradition, the Hasidic Jews and so on. So it's the mystical understanding of the world where the world is divine, but you are divine as well. It's not what you find in organized religions, where God is out there, and you have to go through a system, through a hierarchy, usually for some donation or something, to reach it. You know, Christina wrote a book, wonderful book called Thirst for Wholeness, and she talked about her experiences in the Episcopalian Church when she was a kid, and they had them chant, "Oh Lord, we are miserable sinners who don't deserve crumbs from your table. We are sick to our core. There is no health in us." So when you have this kind of message, this is a powerful vaccination against spirituality, because the last place where you would look for God is inside, you see. Then you would be dependent on somebody who is sort of offering something on the outside. Mm. So the experiences in these what I call holotropic states are something that you find in the mystical branches of the religion. We're not talking about the dogmas of whether it's Christianity or Islam. Those are in a sense systems which are quite dangerous in today's world, because they bring together a group of people who are relating to the same group of archetypes, but at the same time they set that group against another that has chosen a different axis. You see, we are Christians and you are pagans, and we have to convert you or eliminate you. Or we are Muslims and you are infidels. we're Jews, you're Goyim. But then even the distinctions within the same religion are enough to kill each other. Like, you know, we are Catholics, you are Protestants. We are Sunnis, you are Shiites. That's not the religion that helps the world, you know. The spiritual experiences that I'm talking about are universal. They are all-encompassing. They lead people to a sense of planetary citizenship. They dissolve the boundaries that sort of create conflicts and frictions and problems.
What do you say to the people who often come out of these traditions, let's say Buddhists, who are very serious contemplatives, who spent years meditating, who might say the way to go deeper, to tap into these different realms, is through your inner work, through meditation. It's not through a substance like LSD, not through psychedelics. That's almost cheating. It's a matter of sort of figuring out how to do it yourself. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, there were very interesting discussions at the beginning when it became clear that psychedelics can take you to a mystical experience. And it was the question of this instant or chemical mysticism.
Right. So the question is that really a mystical experience?
They were very quickly four groups. One was the hardcore scientists who were saying, well, what the mystics think, there are some profound, you know, insights into the nature of reality is nothing but changes of chemistry. So that was one way of looking at those experiences. The other group was saying, no, there is a certain group of plants or substances. They're special substances because they can give you mystical experiences. So let's call them entheogens or flesh of gods, as some of the native cultures call the plants. The third group was very interesting, was based on Walter Pankey's Good Friday experiment, where he gave... in the Harvard Chapel, actually, psilocybin to a group of theological students of theology, and some of them had placebo, and then he was able to show that they had experiences indistinguishable from what you find in spiritual literature. And so the question was, it can generate the experiences, you know, that... you find in spiritual literature, and then the question is, are they of the same value? Do you have to be involved in serious practice or prayer? Does it have to come as grace and so on? And then there was a very interesting fourth position, which was Houston Smith, who said, it depends on the context. If you are a spiritual seeker who has done a lot of meditation, a lot of reading, and you have that experience, it sends you further on that journey. If, you know, you went to a party in Berkeley and there was fruit punch and a joker came with a handful of sugar cubes laced with acid and threw it in there and people were having experiences, some of them happened to have mystical experience, totally out of context, it's not going to really do very much for them, very likely.
So you're saying it's what you bring to it?
It depends on... you know, whether people had the experience or not. Like Meher Baba wrote this God in the Pill. It's absolutely impossible to have the experience of God through chemical means. There were people like Houston Smith, who a scholar, a religious scholar, who himself had experiences, and he said what I just mentioned. I had the chance to actually sit for a couple of Tibetans, and they said this is very powerful. This is an accelerator of karma.
Tibetans who had used psychedelics.
Yeah. Also, Lama Govinda had his experiences and so on. So it depends. You know, some psychics say it creates a hole in your aura, and there are other psychics who say, like Anne Armstrong, for example, said, you know, that they felt that it cleansed them as a channel, that they made them really better psychics. So how do you decide? It's certainly when you have that experience, it feels real. I mean, as far as my own experiences are concerned, I have no question that this was a kind of a mystical spiritual path, but I never took it for kicks, you know. I always took it really with an intense need to know.
We could keep going on, but we should leave it there. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was a real pleasure.